We see similar kinds of things happen in non-human subjects. Now, you know, we may not want to describe a rat's behavior as fear or pigeons or something that seems to be a kind of anthropomorphic human-type label to slap onto it, but there have been a number of studies, actually very standard, studies of looking at fear-type responses, whether it's the emotion fear or a strictly physiological response to a dangerous or painful situation. We can quibble about that, probably best quibbled about over beer, but here's what's often done. Shocks are typically utilized then as an unconditional stimulus. Now, if you're working with rats, rats are great for doing this. A lot of the studies with this technique are used with rats for the reason that they produce a very nice species-specific response. That is, they very typically freeze. If something scary or dangerous, threatening is going to happen, and we talked about this a little bit earlier, if there is a threat that's in close proximity, rats and mice will often just freeze in place and not move. Probably because many of the sort of predators that rodents are likely to encounter are sight-based movement predators, movement-driven predators. So if you're doing this with rats or mice, they often just freeze in place and won't move once they've learned that a stimulus indicates that a shock is going to be coming. Now, with things like mice and rats, it's very difficult to do stuff like measure the amount of saliva they produce, you know, a drip of saliva, that kind of thing. So this freezing response can produce a very nice measure of a conditional response. There's something you have to do first, and we haven't gotten to this yet, but we will. Basically, you go through and you train up an operant response first. So basically, you train your rats or your mice to press a lever to get food, okay? We'll talk next week about how this is done, but basically, just for now, accept they've learned to press levers to get food. Then you take and do your standard classical conditioning training, a CS plus for an aversive unconditional stimulus, the shock. So it could be a light, or it could be a tone, whatever it is, it doesn't really matter. You pick something. So the CS is presented, then a shock is presented. CS is presented, shock. Okay. You then take and you go, okay, that's great. Now, how do we actually measure this freezing response? So if the conditional, if the UR is freezing, if the CR is freezing, not moving, how do we actually measure this? We put our say, a rat back into the, it's called an operant chamber, where they've got the little lever they can press for food. So you put them back in there, you let them press on the lever for food, then you present the conditional stimulus. Now, if the classical conditioning has actually worked, the conditional stimulus should produce a conditional response of not moving. If you're not moving, you can't press the lever, or at least your lever pressing is going to go down. So if we see a reduction in lever pressing, that is a suppression of the behavior during the presentation of the conditional stimulus, we'd say, yeah, there we go. We've got a conditional response. I mention this in some detail because there is just a question on the second assignment that has something to do with this. All right, here's a little video. Which will hopefully load now. So, conditional expression. So, oh, Long Evans rat, hooded rat. There's a little lever it can press. Yeah. Press the lever, look for, oh, see, got a little shock, there's a little jump there. Little foot shocks there, coming at the end of the tone. Okay, notice what's happening. It's not pressing the lever. sitting very still. There's the shock. Okay, so we're getting a suppression of the behavior. We're getting that freezing response. Doesn't mean they necessarily don't move at all, but the behavior decreases. Okay. Now, the measure we use for this is called a suppression ratio. Okay, standardly used in behavioral sciences now, used for decades and decades. So suppression ratio is calculated by taking the amount of responding that is done during the conditional stimulus and then dividing it by responding done while the conditional stimulus is presented and the amount of responding that's done in a generally period of time equal to the length of the CS presentation, so-called the pre-CS responding. So in other words, if your conditional stimulus is on for 10 seconds, you would measure the number of responses made during the CS, and you would typically measure the number of responses made in the 10 seconds before the conditional stimulus was presented. So number of responses during the CS divided by the total number of responses in that, say, 20-second period. Okay? If your value is going to be zero. Okay, so if you get no responding during the CS divided by however much, that means there has been complete suppression. You've got a really strong conditional response there. Classical conditioning did that well. If you get a value of 0.5, let's say you make 10, the rat makes 15 responses during the CS and 15 responses in the 10 seconds before the CS. So 15 divided by 15 plus 15, 15 divided by 30, 0.5. There's no suppression at all. Your mouse or rat or whatever it is hasn't learned anything about the CR. At least it's certainly not demonstrating that it's learned anything. It just keeps responding. Okay? So a value of 0.5 is no suppression, which means at least by this measure, no learning. Okay? And something in between, you know, like down here, indicates a partial strength conditional response. Okay, let's leave sort of the fear responses behind here. Let's talk a little bit about prejudice. While we could quibble about this, for our purposes, it's a reasonable assumption to make here. Let's sort of say that prejudice is closely related to issues of hatred. Now, the question is whether or not hatred, and I guess we could suggest that hatred is somehow related to fear. And, you know, there maybe are some things that we have an innate fear of. Primates tend to have an innate fear of, I describe it as things that have too many or too few legs. Carries over to people. We tend to see people having phobias of things like things with too many legs, like spiders, scorpions. Oddly enough, not usually fears of things like king crabs when they're cooked and dipped in butter. They definitely have too many legs. And things that have too few legs, like snakes. These are probably related to our ancestors developing an innate fear of things that perhaps were poisonous and might kill you off. We do see this in terms of other non-human primates. There have been a variety of studies that do show that things like, for example, certain monkeys do not actually have to learn to be afraid of things like hawks. They have an innate predisposition to avoid things like hawks, which would be a natural predator. but for our purposes, let's suggest that prejudice is related to hatred here. Now, we know from a variety of research that we can actually condition hatred in people, or at least serious dislike. So study by Stats and Stats, this one's a lovely study, going back into the 50s, and very simple methodologically to perform. What they did was they had subjects rate nationalities, Canadian, Swedish, Brazilian, whatnot. So they said, here's a list of nationalities on a scale from 1 to 5, where 1 is really, really can't stand or really hate this nationality, and 5 is greatest one ever. Just rate these. Okay, so they got their subjects to go through and rate all of these various nationalities. Then what they did was they would present the subjects, randomized this, they would present their individuals with the nationality, the name of the nationality, paired with a descriptor. So these descriptors would be either positive, negative, or neutral words. So, could be something like happy or filthy or, orange, whatever, teapot. You'd see like Canadian, teapot, presumably fairly neutral, Swedish, filthy, and so on and so on. And different subjects got different descriptors, positive, negative, neutral. So it was all randomized. They then went back after it was done and gave the subjects the nationality rating scale again, said, okay, please go back and rate the nationalities again. What they found was that after this really simple little process, they found that subjects that were given negative words with the nationality, they subsequently rated that nationality more negatively than they did initially. For subjects that were given positive words paired with the nationality, they rated those nationalities more positively, and for those that got the neutral, it really had no statistical effect. So in this really simple, just one-time presentation of words, and they're using adults here, right? So these are native speakers of English who have had lots of years of experience with the language. So the meanings of these words have already, filthy or happy, teapot, whatever, have already been nicely established. There's been conditioning. They've learned the language. They've made associations in the past about whether these are, quote-unquote, good or bad words. So just the pairing of one of these descriptors with a nationality, at least over the short time that this little study was done, are enough to cause people to change their ratings in a statistically significant way. Now, probably didn't last terribly long, this one-off sort of thing. In a similar way, we know that short-term presentations to, say, things like violence in movies does not have a really long-lasting effect. But if we are continuously presented with these descriptors, that will have a longer-term effect. You're doing repeated conditioning trials, if you will. Okay, so we see this in all kinds of things. Political speeches, media coverage, the use of negative images, words, impressions that get paired up with an identifiable group. These can change people's attitudes towards groups, events, organizations, social groups, political organizations. I mean, negative attack. We have an American election coming up pretty soon. Watch it. Watch what happens with... I mean, we already have a bunch of negative attack ads going on down in the States. Fortunately, the provincial election here in Alberta was relatively low on negative attack ads, but we had some. Watch how this changes. Historically, go back and look at the way that countries, when they are at war with another country, go back and look at the words that are used in media to describe that other nationality. My mom's family, her ancestors, came to North America in 1712. So before there was the United States, part of Germans called the Palatine Deutsch Protestants. They got moved in to hold part of the North American territory, like Mississippi and Missouri and whatnot, and parts of Michigan, basically to grab land from the natives and keep the French from getting it. Doesn't matter. My point is, they were here for a heck of a long time, before the First World War comes around, about 200 years. Okay, But they still spoke German at home. My grandmother's family, they stopped speaking German at home during the First World War. They were more American than people that have showed up after that, because they'd been here before there was the United States. They, in fact, fought in the American Revolutionary War on the side of the colonies, part of the founding of this. But they spoke German at home on their farm. They stopped that because of all the negative media that was going along with being German in 1916. The United States didn't actually get involved in the First World War until 1917, the end of it, but there was negative press. If you were German, you were evil, you were horrible, you were oppressors, you were rapists, all of this. They spoke German, they spoke English as well, but they'd spoken German for the last 200 years in America, and they stopped. Because of stuff like this, being visibly identified as being German was bad. Now, think of what's been happening over the last decade in the United States, the war on terror, nationality, and various ethnic groups. Prejudice can be conditioned. Mary Cover Jones, told you we'd get back to her, okay? 1924. Mary says, well, actually, she didn't say, I'm going to do this. She got her PhD, and then she ends up actually doing essentially clinical. Well, she's interested in developmental, as it turns out. But she ends up getting involved with some applied developmental, interestingly enough. One of, again, the first people that was actually doing this. And so she ends up with a family that comes, gets referred to her, and they've got a little boy named Peter. And Peter is terrified of rabbits. I mean, you know, maybe Rosalie Rayner was like hiding behind trees and throwing rabbits at him like she did at Elmer. We don't know. It's like, ah, rabbit attack. We have no idea why Peter was afraid of rabbits. Never exactly clear. I mean, his family life was messed up to begin with. Jones talks about this in her paper where she describes everything that was done. So bad family life to begin with. But we don't know why, of all things, he's afraid of bunny rabbits. But he is. So she gets this family and Peter get referred to her because she's working with like school groups and whatnot for developmental psychology and blah, 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 blah. Anyway, says, okay, I think I can reduce, or maybe I can try using classical conditioning in the way that Watson had meant to with Elbert to reduce this phobia. It doesn't matter how we got the phobia. I should be able to, if we assume that fears can be classically conditioned, then assume that they can also be removed through classical conditioning. So, this is what she did. She found out what a favorite snack of Peter's was, something he really, really liked to eat. She said, okay, don't give this to him anymore. Okay, the only time he gets the snack is when he's with me in the therapy sessions. So, what she would do is she'd give Peter this really preferred treat, sit there eating it. Peter was about, I think, 3.5, 4 at this point. So he eats the snack, and then she'd bring a rabbit into the room. Now, initially, this rabbit would be kind of far away from Peter, on the other side of the room sort of thing. Okay, so there's a rabbit there. Now, I kind of imagine it's like a suppression, conditioned suppression, so Peter freezes. not eating the snack. Anyways, but he really likes the snack, so he's eating the snack. The only time he gets the snack is when there's a rabbit present. See where this is going. Keeps doing this. And the rabbit is gradually brought closer and closer to Peter. So, you know, not only does she not throw the rabbit at him. See the rabbit? Yeah. Catch, you know. She doesn't do that, which is good. It's what we call good in a therapeutic setting. The only time he gets the snack that he wants is in the presence of the rabbit. So, no. In the past, we would say somehow the rabbit has become a conditional stimulus for a fear response. But now, the rabbit is becoming a conditional stimulus for this very desired snack, this treat, which makes Peter really, really happy. He likes this treat a lot. Now, this takes a while, but what we're seeing happening is the conditioning, the previous conditioning of rabbit equals fear, rabbit produces fear response, that gradually gets weaker until now rabbit predicts the onset of the yummy treat. Now, I'm not sure that Peter ever got to the point where he wanted to, like, you know, gamble and frolic with, you know, meadow full of rats, but at least he's no longer terrified, runs screaming from rabbits. So this positive, this appetitive unconditional stimulus gets associated with an initially negative CS, an aversive CS, and it becomes at least neutral or somewhat positive CS. So classical conditioning. So classical conditioning approach to the reduction in phobias. This has been expanded over the years. Once Cover-Jones reported on this in 1924, others very quickly started picking up on this and realizing that, yes, there may be some things other than Freudian psychoanalysis to try to reduce phobias. And the beauty of this is, right, I mean, traditionally, I mean, this is why Freud's approach was such a big thing, right? Even if there's problems with it, it was sort of the first time there was any even sort of theory behind how can we try to help people with psychological problems, as opposed to just institutionalizing them or locking them up in an attic, which for a really long time been kind of the standard way of dealing with people that were a little, okay? So even if there are problems with Freud's approach, it was a big step forward. But the beauty of applying classical conditioning here is you don't really need to know the details of why someone's got a phobia. So if you've got someone who's like a young kid who has the phobia, you know, you can't make them talk through it. It's like, yeah, so, well, why are you afraid of furry things, right? You can't necessarily ask them. They may not know, but it doesn't matter. It's like, what do they like to eat? Something yummy? Great, let's use that. So you can start doing phobia reductions and improving other behaviors as well without the necessity of delving into people's deep psyche, which for, you know, young kids is a problem. For people that may have a lot of psychological problems, could be a real difficulty, especially if they're not talking or a little bit demented, have some dementia. So this can be very, very useful. Okay. So it gets expanded, and it becomes a technique called systematic desensitization. Now, in the modern approach to systematic desensitization, what happens is individuals are taught a deep relaxation technique, a meditative technique or a way of sort of calming down, right? So if your blood pressure spikes when you're introduced to this scary thing, whatever it is, gone through a taught techniques to try to reduce that. Okay. And then the phobic stimulus is gradually introduced. In some cases, in fact, it's not even initially introduced physically. It's just like, all right, imagine a very small bunny rabbit on the far side of the room, locked in a cage. Are you imagining that? Yeah. On a scale of 1 to 10, how nervous does this make you? Probably an 8. Okay, do your relaxation technique. Whatever it is. Okay, how are you feeling now? What's your stress level? 3. Okay, good. Now, imagine that we move very small bunny rabbit in the cage, a little close, okay, and so on and so on and so on. So you may even start just in a visualization situation. Then eventually, once that's under control, you move on to, we're going to bring an actual small bunny rabbit into the room, put it in a cage on the far side. Okay? Maybe done that way. The problem, well, this is great, but systematic desensitization is, with respect to relaxation techniques, hard to do with young kids, because they don't usually sit still very long. And it can also be difficult to do with, say, elderly or people that have some dementia. So you may just have to find, instead of using the relaxation, you may just need to find an appetitive unconditional stimulus that you can pair up. Another technique is called flooding. Basically, with flooding, what you do is you, that's why it's called flooding, you flood the patient with exposure to fear-inducing stimuli. So if you've got someone who's afraid of spiders, you should lock them in a phone booth with 6,000 spiders. Okay, probably not ideal. If you work in this field, if you're going to do flooding therapy, you should always get paid in advance. Think about it. Okay. The idea, flooding is not always a preferred way of doing things. It's often used if you really have to try to reduce a phobia quickly. Systematic desensitization works, and it works well, but it's not a fast process. It's a very gradual process. If someone is afraid of flying and they have to be on a plane in 2 days because of a funeral they have to travel cross-country for, you're just not going to get it done with systematic desensitization. What you have to do with flooding, flooding works based upon extinction. So, to do flooding right, you have to expose the patient to a very strong aversive conditional stimulus, the thing that they are afraid of, but you have to do this in a very controlled way so that nothing bad actually happens to them. They'll have their stress response, right? I'm freaking out. But nothing else horrible happens, right? They don't actually get bitten by a spider. The plane doesn't go into a tailspin. They don't have to parachute out of it to safety, right? You know. Okay. This does make it a little bit difficult to actually do flooding successfully. Some people self-flood flood themselves out of a phobia. I didn't like, I still don't love heights, but back when I was in high school, I really didn't like heights. And of course, you know how sometimes graduating class decide to give something back to the school that made their life hell for 3 years? It's a weird thing. Our class decided they would paint a mural in the school gym. Okay, fine. Except they're going to paint it 30 feet off the ground, you know, way up on the wall. So scaffolding's there. And of course, I agree to be involved in this because, you know, the person who was designing the picture and the murals, this girl that I liked. Guys do a lot of really stupid things because of women. Anyways, so, you know, and you don't want to demonstrate that you're afraid of heights. You're trying to, you know. Anyhow, so, yes, for a couple of days I just, you know, sat on the edge of the scaffolding, like clutching it. Kind of thing. Eventually got over it, sort of. Helped paint the picture, and she went to prom with somebody else. So that was all pretty much wasted. But, hey, I can be on a scaffolding now. So self-flooding. Moving on. Okay. All right. Let's talk about advertising for a bit, because advertising is a lot of fun, and we see it, you know, daily. Okay. We've talked about first order conditioning. Pair a CS directly with a US. We see this in advertising. So our product. Let's say we got a new product on the market. Okay. So initially, this is going to be this new product is neutral. People don't know much about it at this point. So we're going to treat this as our conditional stimulus. So we are going to pair the brand name, the logo, the whatever it is, with some stimulus that's going to elicit a positive emotional response. So that's going to be your US, the stimulus that makes you feel good. Here's the idea. If we do this enough, then now when you see the brand name, the logo, the product, whatever it is, you have this association with this positive emotional state. And now this isn't necessarily saying you will buy the product, but at least if you see the product and you feel good, well, I just saw this, you know, box of cereal, I feel good, right? If you see a box of cereal and you're like, I hate this cereal, filled with rage, you're probably not going to buy it, right? Hate these shoes, Hulk smash. Okay, but like the mini wheats, right? If you develop an aversion to that, you know, you're in the mini wheat commercials. You know, you're now going into the supermarket and like finding a spatula and attacking the boxes of mini wheats. Yeah, that's what they don't want to have happen. Okay, kids often like the mini wheats commercials, right? They're a cartoon or Crack Snapple Pop or Tony the Tiger. You know, these are all things that kids can enjoy. Anyways, so the idea is make it something that makes people happy. They may not necessarily buy it, but they're at least less likely to attack it or run in horror away from it. Okay, so here's an example.
Great. Oh, and what was the housing one last year back on the market? They're asking whose phone this is.
Funny, right? Funny. A few people laughed. Okay. So, post-bank, we've got a funny situation here. That's our unconditional statement. It's funny. The you are, happiness, and amusement, whatnot. Post-bank is the brand. That's our CS. And then, presumably, if you are in the market for banking needs, you're thinking, which bank should I go to? And you look through, find advertisers with Post-bank. If you just have a positive response then, whether or not you can remember why you have that response, if you just feel slightly better about Post-bank as opposed to, Royal Bank, then maybe you go with Post-bank. Okay? So, very straightforward, very simple, first-order classical conditioning, very commonly used in advertisement. You see this a lot. That's why there's so many ads that try to be funny. I mean, Budweiser commercials in the Super Bowl. I mean, they've been designing funny ads for years. That's what I was trying to do. Now, we can also use higher-order conditioning, second-order or higher-order conditioning in this as well. Ever wondered why we so often see celebrities in advertisements? People that are well known for either being attractive or beautiful or being in movies or they're rich or whatever they are. Or they're seen to be an expert in something or whatnot. Okay? So celebrities, people that are seen as being knowledgeable about an area, a field, these are commonly used in ads as well. So we've got a higher order conditioning here. When we've got this celebrity, could be like David Suzuki, right? In terms of environmentalism. David Suzuki, the nature of things for years. In Canada, he's a well-known environmentalist. If that's been established. 20, 25 years of establishing David Suzuki as this guy that cares about the environment. So a couple of years ago, they were doing, David Suzuki was involved in ads to, reduce electricity consumption of things in the house. Okay, so you just show up in the ads. And it's they even specify, Bob has a beer fridge in the basement. And it's suddenly part of the wall comes down, falls down, and David Suzuki steps in, and Bob goes, David Suzuki's in my basement. It's that's right, Bob. Your beer fridge is using this much electricity per year. Do you know how much that costs? No. It costs this much. Wow. That's a lot of beer from the store. That's right, Bob, says David Suzuki. Be good for your environment. Just go buy your beer from the store. Blah, 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 blah. Okay. Wow, Dr. Snyder, what are you doing in my basement? Well, Bob, this fridge costs a lot of money. How do you know that? Who the hell are you? Why should I listen to you? All right, but David Suzuki, associated with the environment. Okay, so there we go. So that's been established, or an actor, actress, whatever. They've been established with, they're rich, they're famous, they're whatever it is. Okay, that's been built up over time. Okay, so that's your CS1 US condition. Now, we take the brand, the product, the movement, the cause, whatever it is. We pair that, we get the celebrity to be a spokesperson for it. Okay, so now we're pairing our CS2, the brand, the product, whatever it is, with our celebrity who has already, through movies, films, programs, previous exposure, has already been very strongly conditioned to the public. Okay, so we don't necessarily, you can bring first-order conditioning in and make this funny as well, but you don't even need to. Right? Richard Gere is a spokesperson for Tibet, Free Tibet. Richard Gere is not actually all that funny when he does, things about Free Tibet. It doesn't have to be he's the rich, famous, attractive Richard Gere. That's enough. Okay? Well, if Richard Gere thinks we should free Tibet, we should probably free Tibet. Why? Well, I don't know, but I kind of like Richard Gere as an actor. Okay. If you kind of like Richard Gere, you probably kind of like a free Tibet. Really? That's as simple as it gets? Okay, that's the idea of it. Okay? Yes, we really are like rats when it comes to advertising. Okay, so here's a somewhat long example.
When did I wake?
less of any other person in the world.
You're not supposed to be laughing. That's not the idea. Obviously, different demographic. Lots of stuff going on here. I mean, the disappearance of the most famous actress in the world. It's like, yeah, okay, no, okay. I must have been the only person who didn't know who she was. Yeah, no kidding. Yeah. Sorry.
And that commercial actually got the world record for most money per minute.
Yeah, yeah, stunning. It was a stunning one. Director of Moulin Rouge, Baz Luhrmann. Thank you. Yeah, did this. So, and there's Moulin Rouge references there. You know, I'm a dancer. I love to dance. It's like, pickoon. Anyone who's seen Moulin Rouge, I mean, this is what's happening. It's coming right after the movie. Nicole Kidman. I mean, it's like we're troweling it on, kind of thick here. But that's kind of the point, right? So it's setting up. It's not just in Nicole Kidman pretending to be a famous actress. It is Nicole Kidman, right? So that's what they're setting up here. I mean, up until this point, Nicole Kidman had really only played positive roles in movies. You know, I think Golden Compass was like the first time she plays a questionably borderline evil psychotic kind of individual. But up until this point, all of her characters were very, very positive. I mean, she came out of the whole, look, when it comes out of the whole Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman breakup, I mean, who comes off looking crazy? Jumping up and down on Oprah's couch? Yeah, Tom Cruise. Okay. We've got this here. So Nicole Kidman, she's already branded, okay? She is a brand at this point herself. She's the CS1 that's been paired up through all kinds of movies. So positive feelings. People think about Nicole Kidman, they generate these positive feelings. Why? Well, I mean, in movies, characters she's played in movies, and even, just her as an actress in real life, she's attractive, she's been successful in movies, she's got this very seemingly glamorous lifestyle. These are all kinds of things that humans want to have, right? Although some of us will deny it, we'd like to have money, successful friends, be attractive, have hair, these sorts of things. Anyways, so the positive feelings generated by this, that's who you are. Kidman is a brand already. If you just picked a random, attractive actress to play the role that she did, this wouldn't have worked as well. Right? If it's like, the most famous actress in the world, really? Who is this? I have no idea. I mean, attractive, it works because it is this terribly famous actress. And then we've got Chanel No. 5. Right? That's then the brand that is being paired up with Kidman. And here's what they're trying to tell you. If you buy this perfume, you will be like Nicole Kidman. You will be famous. You'll be rich. You'll be beautiful. You will get the cute guy who will sit on top of buildings, precariously perched there, pining for you. Who wouldn't want that? Maybe a few people. But this is the aim of here. They're also doing other stuff, right? I mean, the lights, the red carpet. They're implying, you know, the golden age of Hollywood, going back into like the 30s and the 40s and the plushness and the richness of all of this. So very interesting ad here. There's some other great ones here. If you want to kill a few minutes, go take a look at Japander.com. Japander.com puts up advertisements of Western celebrities that are shown pretty much only in Japan. Matter of fact, many of the ads they do is specifically written into the contract that they are not to be broadcast outside of Japan. Because some of them are just bizarre. Let's look at one or two. Let's see. I think it's this one. And will this work for me? Oh, let's just say yes. That's the ad. It's for jeans. Edwin, 503 jeans. That's it. It's Brad Pitt. I mean, Brad Pitt wearing jeans. I mean, honestly, what more do you really need to know? I mean, again, Brad Pitt is this brand at this point. He's the CS1. The jeans are the CS2. If you wear these jeans, you too will be like Brad Pitt. Specifically, you will be somewhat similar to Brad Pitt's ass. Wear the jeans at Brad Pitt's ass. I mean, honestly, what more do we have to say about that one? You know, those wouldn't have worked as well with just any sort of random pretty boy male model. Okay, but I mean, this works brilliantly. Works brilliantly for it. Here's another one. So it was being done back when Pierce Brosnan was playing James Bond, and frankly, you pretty much have to have lived in a hole in the ground for about the last four decades not to have heard of the Bond movie franchise. Okay, stunningly well known. The theme music, okay, is terribly well associated, right? Bond as a character, played by multiple actors over the years, but the persona of Bond, right? License to Kill. Has the coolest toys, right? He's a spy, he gets the ladies, he destroys space satellites, he saves the world. Right? How cool is that? Pretty cool. If there was any credit card that James Bond would carry, what would it be? Obviously, it would be Visa. If you want to be like James Bond, get Visa. Right? I mean, they're intentionally setting this up as James Bond. I mean, they're not saying, "Hi, I'm James Bond." I mean, it's clear through the rest of it. It's Pierce Brosnan, the actor playing James Bond. He's set in a foreign location. You know, this little cart jumping through signs. The music. Okay, so this is all set up. The Bond persona has been very well established at this point. Wouldn't have worked nearly as well if it's just like, "I'm Pierce Brosnan and I use Visa." Well, okay. I mean, it's not bad, but it's better this way. Yeah. Yeah, similar idea there. Sarah McLachlan, people that know Sarah McLachlan, that like her music, that like the things she stands for, various environmental aspects, various other things there. So there's the idea. It's like, I'm Sarah McLachlan, and I think you should save puppies. Okay. I mean, if it was like some random person going, I'm Random Citizen, and I say you should save puppies. Why? I mean, sure, it's just, but it's all set up. People like the music. They like her as an individual. It's established. Yeah. Right. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, Russell Peters, Canadian comedian, very funny guy. Yeah, and I mean, this goes back to what we were talking about exactly. I mean, the use of, you know, racial stereotypes, skin color, and certain careers, convenience stores, you said, getting arrested or not. I mean, cops, you know. They would, you know. And then he's going to tear his shirt off, and the police will have to chase him down. Yeah, all of this, sure, it gets back to what we said as well with issues of, prejudice, conditioning of prejudice, conditioning of expectation, conditioning of stereotypes, right? Abu in The Simpsons, right? You know, it was the quickie store, convenience store. I think Big Bang Theory even had a little bit like that. It's like, that's racist. It's like, no, it's not. Abu was a much beloved character on The Simpsons. How can that be racist? It's like, you're missing the point. And that's the point of the little funny bit in The Big Bang Theory. It's like, you've missed the point of the point. This is it. Once you start thinking about how this is classical conditioning and how this leads to setting up people's expectations or stereotypes about things, boom, it really expands. You start seeing this throughout life, media. And just day-to-day sorts of existences. So, this is all very interesting, stuff. I don't have it up here, but just for pure amusement's sake, let me, because these are, where is it? Oh, yes. Yeah, these are bizarre. He's just been insulted. They're laughing at him. Daijo Bui is an energy drink. Anyways, bizarre, right? But as I said, Schwarzenegger, he's set up, he's established as a brand in and of himself, right? So, you know, this is the thing, Daijo Boy, it's an energy drink, it's supposed to make you strong and confident, and right? And there's, you know, this is back when Schwarzenegger was in the peak of his action hero career, so, you know, he takes the drink and then he becomes the success, the action hero, he becomes bold. So you drink this, you will be like Arnold Schwarzenegger. Divorced, no longer governor, that sort of stuff. That sort of stuff. It probably wouldn't work quite as well today. The more you watch advertising and stuff now, commercials on TV or radio or whatnot, just think about this a little bit. You start seeing this all over. You'll start encountering this. Okay, let's talk a little bit about paraphilia. Technically, it just means incorrect love. If you really want to get into paraphilia, go take the abnormal psych class. That's partially why people take it, because it's all this weird, sexy, strange stuff. But paraphilias include all kinds of things like fetishism, masochism, pedophilia, rape, you know, abnormal psych. Okay. Lots of ways that this has been approached. I mean, you know, Freud suggested this was unconscious forces. Behavioral geneticists suggest there may be some genetic predispositions involved. Learning behavioral theorists suggest that there could be, not in all cases, but in some cases at least, classical conditioning components involved in these abnormal behaviors. We do know, interestingly enough, that these are more common, more commonly found in males than females, which suggests that it's not strictly a learning component. There's some other things going on here as well. But there certainly could be learning components in at least some of these cases. So let's consider just masochism here, the enjoyment of pain, taking sexual pleasure out of painful situations. What we've been talking about so far, as I've said, usually what we're going to do is we're going to take a neutral stimulus, something that hasn't had any sort of prior conditioning or whatnot, and set that up as the conditional stimulus. I mean, that's what Pavlov was doing, taking bells and tones and lights that his dogs had never really experienced before, and establishing those, pairing them with an unconditional stimulus there to get the conditional response. But you can also take an unconditional stimulus and turn it into a conditional stimulus. Now, in fact, Pavlov actually did do this. He took I said earlier, he would work with like things like food and shock as his unconditional stimuli. So he took actually a mild shock, which causes a flinch response in dogs, pretty standard there. So he took a mild shock, and then he paired it up with food. Now, our food is going to be an unconditional stimulus as well. So the only time the dog was getting the food was just after getting this mild shock. And what he found was that after a number of these conditioning pairing trials, he actually got a conditional response to the shock of salivation, not a flinch. So now the shock produced salivation, predicts the coming of the food. So in this case here, a mild shock, which is a US, can actually be turned into a conditional stimulus. Okay, so with that contextualization, let's consider masochism. So we've got a painful stimulus. That's going to be our CS. And our painful stimulus indicates that sexual pleasure, the US, is coming. So think about the preparedness interpretation. So through conditioning, one can come to learn that being abused is going to ultimately lead to sexual satisfaction. For most people, this seems a little bit peculiar, hence paraphilia, but contextualized in the framework of Pavlov's work with taking a shock and turning into a CS, we can see how this could potentially occur. So perhaps at some point in a masochist life, it starts with a mildly painful experience, eventually leading to sex, and then over time, with intolerance development, this gradually increases until we're getting into much more degrading or painful experiences. Now, keep in mind, I am not suggesting this is the way that all cases of masochism start, nor am I suggesting that all cases of paraphilia are due to learning. Okay? But certainly could explain some aspects of this. Perhaps not all the behavior in an individual, even some of the behavior. So if you are interested in future career in therapy, it is well worth considering, given that our brains are very good at learning things. That's one of the things our species is really adept at, is considering that there can be multiple vectors coming into a clinical framework. So worth keeping in mind. We can take and apply some of these ideas of classical conditioning in therapeutic context. Well, we already saw this with phobias. So phobia reduction in terms of Peter and his fear called counterconditioning. But we can do this with other things as well. So we could take and pair a conditional stimulus then with a very strongly aversive unconditional stimulus. So I mentioned lithium chloride earlier with respect to taste aversion in rats. There's other drugs like that that will produce stomach upset, strong laxatives, all kinds of things that could in fact be used. So we can take some stimulus, let's say, and this has been applied for, and I'm not justifying this one way or the other. I mean, for example, cross-dressing is one that has been applied to for some time. Honestly, I don't really care if people want to cross-dress. It doesn't bother me, but historically in the field, this has really bothered some people. So, you know, go back and says, yeah, okay, time you cross-dress, we will give you the equivalent of lithium chloride so you are very, very sick. Okay, so if that's the issue then, now, you know, cross-dressing, associate that with illness, maybe the person will want to cross-dress. In fact, actually, I mean, groups like the American Psychological Association have, over the last 20 years, generally started disavowing many of these sorts of aversive, they're called aversion therapy techniques with things like cross-dressing or homosexual behavior or many of the sexual behavior practices that are seen nowadays to generally not be terribly harmful psychologically. These become social issues. So it's called aversion therapy. You can do it with cigarettes or alcoholism. So you take the alcohol, you pair it up with something that makes a person ill, you know, you smell the alcohol. Essentially, you set up a taste aversion to it. Maybe that will reduce the alcoholism. This doesn't work well with a variety of behaviors, like pedophilia. This has been tried over the years with pedophilia, so you got a pedophile, we will now show them pictures of young children, and we will then make them sick. Therefore, the idea is now the young pictures of the young children, the imagery of young children, should become a CS for a very strongly aversive US. Problem should be solved, right? Doesn't work very well. So again, suggesting this doesn't apply to all of these abnormal psychology situations. Few minutes left here. Let's talk about taste aversion. So I introduced taste aversion last class. Years ago, my father developed a case of taste aversion. My father's a biomedical physicist, smart guy. My dad and I used to have this years back sort of tradition of going and buying, which for us were kind of like unusual foods. We're very middle class white back then, for Christmas dinner. So, you know, this one year we ended up picking up kimchi and kippers to go along with, like, the turkey. Kippers are a small smoked fish, and kimchi is a spicy pickled Asian cabbage. Both delicious. Now, my father had actually had kippers before he did his postdoc in England and lived for quite some time on kippers on toast because they didn't pay postdocs anything back then. Still don't pay postdocs very much now, but regardless. So he's familiar with kippers. Kimchi was something new. I think he'd had like maybe once, but never really had. Okay, long story short, Christmas dinner, yada, 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 have the food, have the turkey, have the kimchi, have the kippers, great. A couple hours later, I'm upstairs. My mom is screaming at me to get down to the basement. Run down to the basement. And my dad's got this big work room in the basement stuff, and he's lying flat on the concrete floor, and he's like, he can't move. Well, he can move, but anytime he moves, he feels violently. He's like, what's going on? He's a biomedical physicist, okay? So he goes, well, I'm not certain, but I may have just had a heart attack. He's like, let's call an ambulance. He's like, scientist, like, no, let's do a few tests first to find out. What? Like, take my pulse at my throat. Take my pulse at my wrist. They're not the same. You've had a heart attack. He says, no, that's supposed to be that way. Okay, go get the flashlight on the workbench. This is a flashlight for like spotting deer from like 500 meters, or like, shining, sending, signaling the alien mothership kind of thing. So it's like, okay, it's not a heart attack. Maybe it's a stroke. It's like, maybe I've just had a stroke. So it's like, shine into my eye. Did the pupil dilate or contract? You don't have a pupil anymore. I think I've just burned a hole through your skull. It's like, oh. Probably wasn't a stroke then. And so we go through a few more of these things. He's trying to self-diagnose. And eventually it's like, well, just get me upstairs. And the problem is when we try to move him, he basically feels like he's going to throw up. He's stunningly nauseous. Finally, after a couple more hours, he agrees he's not getting any better. We phone an ambulance. They take him off to the hospital. The doctor looks at him and is like, you've got an inner ear infection. Duh! Why didn't I think of that? Oh. Nauseous. So it's like inner ear. So he's got an inner ear infection, shoot him full of antibiotics, and a couple days later, he's fine. Here's the thing. We've got Christmas leftovers. Christmas kind of gets put on hold this year. And you bring out the leftovers, kippers and kimchi and turkey and ham and yams and all this stuff. And I've never actually literally seen a person turn green, except for this instance. When the kimchi comes past him, nearly throws up on the table, which was not all that cool, he's developed a taste aversion to the kimchi. Now, the kimchi did not cause his inner ear infection. He knows he's a biomedical physicist. He gets how bacteria works. He knows how the kinesthetic canals in the ear work. Right? But some part of his brain goes, what's this novel thing that you ate? What's this new food that you've never had before? Kimchi. Then you got horribly nauseous. Let's put one and one together. Well, we get three. In this case, but his brain's concluded that it's the kimchi that caused him to become so nauseous. Couldn't eat kimchi for years. Well, he actually still doesn't eat it, but he can at least go into a Korean restaurant now, which he couldn't for years. It was great as a teenager, because if I was losing an argument, like, well, why can't I borrow the car? If I was clearly losing and couldn't extricate myself from the crushing logic, I'd simply just go, kimchi! And as he, I'd make my escape. Very, very useful. So, but here's the thing. He understands how this works. That's what I said before. Classical conditioning doesn't involve the cognitive process per se. Okay. So anyways, we'll stop here. Couple of things. I'm going to give your assignments back. Actually, we don't have any tables up here, so instead of just throwing them out on the floor, I'll walk them outside. There's a couple of tables outside the lobby. We'll lay them down there. You can come grab them. I wasn't stunningly impressed with people's performance. A little disturbed. Many of these questions have been used before in years past. Some of them are new, but there's some problems. I kind of expected the one on what kind of study is this was going to be difficult, and that one really threw people. It's not actually an experimental study. It's a descriptive study. There's no hypothesis. There's really no control in place. There's really no independent variable. There's no experimental groups. At best, all that's happening is we're just explaining some data, presenting it in a graph, but not analyzing it in any way. Regardless, I expected that one. But some of the other stuff, I think there's just sometimes people aren't reading the questions very well. Like, in the context of control theory, I didn't say just tell me about kinesis. It's like, use stuff about the comparator, use the reference input, the actual input, the output, the action system. Talk about those to explain it. Okay, so what I've done, and don't expect me to be doing this on future assignments, but the highest score is 13.5. I've taken, and I've just written down the scores that you got on your assignments. I've added 1.5 points to everyone's assignment for this one. I know it's spring is a tight time frame, okay, we were like 1 week in, some people are like new to the class, what have you, okay, fine. So I've added 1.5 to everyone, so the top grade now is 15, and it goes down, whatever. Don't expect that I'm going to be doing that on subsequent assignments there, but we'll bring this one's grade up a little bit, but you got to actually, think a little bit about this. The questions may seem really, that seems laughingly simple. Nothing is meant to be a trick. There are no trick questions. I am not trying to deceive you based on something that you can't know. Everything in this could have been answered by looking at class notes, lecture, textbook. All of this was doable. Okay? So for the next assignment, I just encourage you to maybe go back, look at your answers, take a peek at them, think about it. Okay. So, anyways, if you didn't do as well as you wanted on this, don't panic at this point, right? It's just one of the assignments. In the grand scheme of the course, it's not worth a giant amount, okay? So take a look at it. I've put comments on it. I will put a key up on the course website as well, but I've written comments down on all the stuff, so you've got that. But do take a look. If you have questions, see me. We can talk about them more after you've had a chance to look at things over.